Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
Across Oklahoma, in urban areas and rural, students alarmed by the Trump administration's sometimes deadly anti-immigrant crackdown are walking out of Sooner classrooms to make clear their opposition to the policy. Unsurprisingly, the fact students are exercising their First Amendment right to free speech and assembly alarms the Oklahoma Legislature's Freedom Caucus. Those hard-right ideologues are not only demanding State Superintendent Lindell Fields investigate the walkouts to determine whether students violated state truancy laws, but also whether teachers were complicit in promoting or facilitating the protests. Oklahoma, of course, has a rich history of student action. Think Clara Looper and her students protesting racism and bigotry and promoting civil rights through their lunch counter sit-ins. Now immortalized in downtown Oklahoma City, with 15 life-sized bronze figures representing Looper, her students, and a Katz drug employee, aside a 4-ton, 16-foot bronze lunch counter. For this week's ObserverCast, Senate Democratic Caucus Chair Michael Brooks Jimenez joins us to discuss efforts to, in effect, silence students and threaten teachers, part of a broader 30 bills plus anti-immigrant agenda that includes a proposal that could criminalize houses of worship and nonprofits that aid the undocumented, threatening fines up to $50,000 and 5 years in prison.
Hello and good afternoon. It is such a pleasure to have you here today. We haven't had you yet on our podcast, so it's just but we always have people for bad reasons to talk about not great issues, but at the same time, it's really great to get to talk to you today. So we always kick off by saying, tell us who you are and what you do.
Yes, ma'am. So my name is Michael Brooks Jimenez. I'm state senator for District 44, which is the south side of Oklahoma City. And when I'm not up at the Capitol, I'm a practicing immigration attorney.
So you bring quite a bit of insight into the things that we want to talk about today. The last episode that we had, we talked with the Reverend Dr. Lori Waukee about the immigration and the ICE raids around the country. And she had spent some time in Minnesota with that situation in January. And then recently we have seen... I'm just going to say the kids are all right. We've seen our high school students start to walk out. And I mean, honestly, truly, I really like that's how I feel about it. We've seen our high school students start to walk out around the country, but specifically in Oklahoma, because of the ICE raids and the immigration situation in the state. And so you've put out a statement about that. And so can you tell us a little bit about, kind of set the scene for us, tell us what's going on. Talk about your district a little bit and how that really impacts your district for those who don't know much about South Oklahoma City. Just kind of set the context for us.
Sure, by all means. And so Senate District 44 is pretty much the traditional south side of Oklahoma City. So it's everything south of Reno Avenue all the way to I-240 from I-44 over to I-35. So the big square just south of downtown. Traditionally, it's been the place probably with the highest level of Latino population, definitely in Oklahoma City. And so as a result, you see lots of Latino-owned businesses, lots of neighborhoods, lots of work trucks. And so kind of with everything that's going on, I think it's probably been the place that's probably been most disproportionately affected by the increase in immigration enforcement, as far as most people maybe pulled over, most people taken into custody as well, unfortunately.
And so what, you know, what I guess what we've seen since these students, I mean, those rascally kids, right? Since we've seen high school students in Oklahoma walk out. And frankly, I'm really kind of surprised at some of the communities where you see kids walking out, like Owosso, for instance.
Edmond.
Edmond,
Right.
right? I mean, and it just reminds me that all of these communities that, like, at first, when I first think of Edmond in Owosso, I think of other affluent white families.
Yes.
Well, immigration impacts us in many ways. I think of the families that have H-1B visa concerns. But just, it's your student next to you in class that you've grown up with for many, many years. And our communities are a lot more complex and diverse than I think we really, really think about. So, tell us about your peers in the legislature, how some of them have responded, specifically the Freedom Caucus. I just want to get you started talking about that.
Well, no, by all means. And so it's interesting, I guess, kind of as the climate has changed nationally, how some of my colleagues have jumped on that bandwagon. And so it's interesting. So for me, whenever I was elected in 2017, probably about 3 years in, one of the goals that I'd had was to increase driver's license eligibility. And so basically to change it to where rather than it being based on immigration status, to be able to base it on something that the state of Oklahoma could control, because we can't control immigration status. That's a federal issue. And so basically what I thought made the most sense was to increase eligibility based on who pays taxes and who or who doesn't. And so as a result, I came up with a bill that would have allowed people, if they could show their state and federal tax returns, that they could be eligible for a driver's license here. And so it looked like that it would increase state re revenue probably by about $50 million. It would re it, and so also it would reduce let's see, it would increase the number of people who were insured, I think, by 75%. And so, based on corollaries from other states, as well as insurance companies would stand to sell, I want to say, an additional $50 million in liability policies, so we could get this done. And so the
I
incidence
mean,
of uninsured
and
motor
just
is.
like to go a little deeper in that, that means
Yeah.
that all insurance rates would go down because there'd be fewer uninsured drivers on the
Exactly.
road, conceivably. So there'd be multiple benefits to such a
Right.
situation.
And so you're exactly right. So when you increase the pool of insureds, the risk that you get hit by someone uninsured goes down. And whenever it goes down, then when your risk goes down, conceivably, I'm not sure if I've ever seen insurance companies do it, but at least conceivably those rates should go down. Or at the very least, the risk should go down.
We'll hold
And
our
so
breath for that one, but yeah.
after getting my feet underneath me as a legislator, I decided to give it a shot. And so it was interesting because I kind of, pounded the pavement, went door to door to each of the members in the Senate and sat down with them individually and explained the benefits when it came to state revenue, as far as also that it was endorsed by at the time by the Fraternal Order of Police, by the Sheriff's Association, and by the Highway Patrol. And so it was one of those things that I think it was kind of shocking to a lot of people, but we were able to get it passed out of committee. And then after that, we were actually able to pass it off the floor of the Senate. And the other interesting thing was during that period of time, I was kind of stalking the governor. And so it was whenever he was about to come up for re-election, and he was reaching out a lot in the Latino community, Latino-owned businesses. And so wherever he would, whatever Mexican restaurant he would show up to, lo and behold, somehow I ended up being the person who got to sit next to him. And so finally, after a few meetings, I had a chance to be able to give him the pitch. And it was interesting, and I didn't have anything to do with it. It was pure coincidence. But when he walked out of the restaurant, there was a Latino journalist there that asked him, "Governor, what do you think about driver's licenses?" And basically, what he said was that if it would reduce the number of uninsured motorists, if I could get it to his desk, he'd sign it. And so unfortunately, the difficulty and the hurdle I couldn't clear was in the House. Trying to be able to get it a committee hearing and to be able to get it heard on the floor of the House. And so it was stuck there. But just kind of what different times, because back then you could kind of talk policy to people from across the aisle, and they were rational enough to understand the public policy benefits, right? Increases in revenue. Also safer for police, because then they have real identification documents to identify people when they deal with them. And then also, the reduction in uninsured motorists. Right now, I get people because I've tried to run it a couple different years, but people who ask me if I'm going to try and run it this year, and you kind of laugh because you kind of have to be able to read the room and know where people are. And so obviously in this year where it seems like immigration is the number one hot button issue, this is not the year to try and, try and expand driver's license eligibility. And so unfortunately, it seems like we're playing a lot more defense, right? And so it seems like I was just reviewing a document, a spreadsheet that says that there are probably about 35 anti-immigrant bills that are currently pending in the legislature right now. And so, some years you get a chance to be able to play offense. Other years, unfortunately, it's a question of playing defense, trying to kill or take the teeth out of as many of those bad bills as you possibly can.
Is some of that, do you think, this year because it's an election year? I mean,
Yeah.
clearly, I was stunned. I was not stunned that the, I call them the Free Dumb, DUMB caucus, would send this
That's
letter.
not you. You don't have to claim that one. Sorry.
Okay,
I
well,
always feel like just
I know, but
all right.
I was not surprised that they would send this letter to this state superintendent. I was a little surprised that your colleague, Senator Pugh, the chair of the Senate Education Committee, signed on because he is regarded by some, at least, as a little more moderate Republican. Although I would argue that some of the things that I've seen suggest that he's Ryan Walters with a smile. But he's a guy who wants to run for, he's going to run for state superintendent. And so, does he show up on a list like this, on a letter like this, because he's playing to the Republican primary audience, do you think?
Perhaps. I think maybe in an election year, you see people file a lot of bills, sometimes that don't have any legs, that don't really have much of a chance of being passed, because it makes a headline or it's something that you can use to be able to support yourself whenever you're campaigning. And so I've not spoken to Senator Pugh directly about his signature on that, but yeah, in response to that statement, I had a chance to be able to respond myself. And so what I wanted to bring out is that the student organizers, community organizers, oftentimes don't get distracted by some of the politics that hangs everybody else up. And so as a result, it seems like they have a clearer gauge of what's good, what's bad, and when they feel mobilized to engage. And when things are so egregious, when they decide to walk out, obviously there are historical precedents throughout American history where that's happened in the past. And I think it's probably appropriate in this situation as well.
Well, after all, we just not too long ago erected a monument in downtown Oklahoma City to the efforts of Clara Luper and company down there
Exactly.
with the sit-ins and student protests and so forth. One of the things that I think has been a little overlooked on this, and that's kind of interesting to me too, is there's an element to all this that suggests that your colleagues would very much like to punish educators who they think somehow are stirring the pot and are encouraging students to exercise their First Amendment rights.
Well, right. I mean, and it's funny because I think it's pretty obvious that it's issue driven, right? If it were a student walkout, and again, I don't like to get overly involved in politics, but if it were a student walkout for some of the issues and maybe some of the causes supported by them, obviously they would stand up in line. Ready to support that, whether it's Charlie Kirk and what's happened with him, other things. I think yeah, it's definitely selective and it's definitely political on behalf of the people at the state capitol. But it is inspiring to be able to see students be able to come out come out in such numbers. And so last week it was interesting. I believe it was I want to say on Wednesday, the several students from Classen School of Advanced Studies, instead of just walking out and marching where they were, they came to the state capitol. And so it was a great experience. I was able to see on social media that they were out there and they were advocating to reform ICE enforcement, which is something that I support. And so I decided to go out on the steps and talk to them. And so it was amazing to see the energy and the vitality that they had and how strongly they felt about this. And so it was funny. I went out and I was kind of surrounded by them, and they were asking, "Well, what can we do? What can we do? Can we write letters? Can we send emails?" And I told them, "Yeah, both of those things are fine. But the interesting thing for you guys is, you're on the steps, but I don't think anybody in the building probably knows you're out here. And so rather than being on the steps, maybe you should, at some point, you should come inside the building where the people are and try and talk to them." And they were all riled up. And it was funny because they're like, "Can you take us in right now?" And I was like,
The door's
"Yeah,
right here.
come on." And so I ended up, I felt like the Pied Piper. So we had probably about 50 kids with signs and banners and everything else. And so here we come to the public entrance of the Capitol. And again, I have to commend the Highway Patrol and the staff there because they were completely and totally professional and supportive and welcoming. One thing, an officer did pull me aside and said, "Can we just make sure there's not going to be any vulgarity?" Right? And I said, "No, but absolutely." And so I talked to the kids, and they were respectful. But after I got in, I called my colleague from the Latino caucus, Representative Arturo Alonso, who's the youngest legislator currently at the Capitol, and he came down, had a chance to be able to talk to them. And then we kind of took them up and down the different floors. And so we had a chance to be able to take them up to the fifth floor where my office is. But at the same time, we had a chance to take them to the governor's office. Again, the governor's office, I went in first, spoke to the receptionist. She said, "Bring them in." And so we brought 50 kids into the little reception area there. And they kind of explained that when they get calls or they get emails, that they review every single one that comes in. And so again, the other thing that I tried to encourage those kids is because they have such a facility with social media and other ways, instead of just having it school by school, maybe to be able to consolidate together in ways to be able to go forward. And so I also mentioned the fact that every year since I've been there, we've had a Latino, a Hispanic Heritage Day at the Capitol. So it's later, it's in May. But to invite them and other people to be able to come out, to be able to celebrate Latino culture and also to be able to advocate on the issues, especially on immigration.
I just wonder, I think this is an interesting kind of note about all of this because, if it was a teacher who, for instance, was a government teacher and he was bringing them to the Capitol as part of a school field trip, I'm just thinking as a teacher, it'd be really interesting to assign them, okay, what's an issue you care about? We're going to go to the state capitol on this day, and you are assigned finding the legislators you want to talk to about it and go and talking to them versus walking out of school and doing almost exactly the same thing. Right? But it's just like during the school day. And so I don't know. I mean, there's so much to be learned from all of this.
Well,
I
and I
mean,
think one of the striking things to me is most of the kids who came out are not, I mean, some of them come maybe from immigrant families, but most of them don't. And so I think one of the most touching and kind of inspiring things is they're not necessarily standing up and advocating on something that impacts them personally so much as on behalf of those people who may not feel safe coming forward right now. And so again, I think those are kind of the tenets of democracy and kind of the reasons that I decided, why I wanted to run for office was my love of the United States, my love of what this place was built on. And so, having real concerns right now about the degradation of those tenets, of those foundations of democracy right now. So.
I mean, can we talk about, student protests as a constitutionally protected right too for minor students?
Yes. Right. Well, I mean, they have a First Amendment right just like anybody else. And so the fact that they were able to organize, they were able to come. I think for the most part, it wasn't necessarily with any faculty, encouragement or support so much as something that they felt called to be able to do on their own. And so they were able to, like I said, at least for class in SAS, they were able to come to the Capitol. And then we're able to speak loudly on the steps, maybe a little bit more quietly, a little bit more civilly inside, but to be able to let everybody know where they stood and where they and how they felt about some of these issues. And so again, unfortunately, I think sometimes the older you are, you tend to kind of become set in your ways and tend to presume that you know everything. And sometimes it takes the voice or the voices of children who can kind of see things, like I said, a little bit more clearly.
So can you give us kind of a read? I'm just curious what you sense the lack of a better term, the temperature is in your district about what's happening with ICE across the country. And I see a lot of, as I'm sure you do, mentions on social media that, oh, there are ICE sightings in Oklahoma City, and that's is there a palpable fear that you sense in your district? Are people leaving because they are afraid they're going to get their families separated, or all those things that we read about elsewhere, that there's going to be violence?
Absolutely. And there's been violence in Oklahoma City and around the state from ICE officers against people that they suspect of being undocumented. And so I think that there have been champions in our community who started 6 months ago or longer as far as being able to document and trying to be the eyes and ears out there of when people are being taken into custody in Oklahoma. And so while we didn't have an increase in the number of ICE officers the way they did in Minnesota, the tactics were very much the same. And so in my law office, I can tell you that one of my secretaries, her son, 35 years old, American citizen, was working as a landscaper, and he was in the truck. His boss got pulled over. They ended up pulling everybody out of the car. The young man explained that he was an American citizen, showed his ID. Basically, the immigration officers discarded the ID and told him it was fake, and then basically used inappropriate language with him. Then they loaded up the young man's coworkers. And as they drove off, they drove over his foot, and so he kicked the truck. And so when he kicked the truck, they came back. They got out of the vehicle, they threw him to the ground, they kicked him in the ribs, and where he had bruises all over his ribs, and they busted out his teeth. And he was an American citizen, and so and he was taken to ICE custody. He was detained there at the ICE detention facility instead of the county jail. The following day, they filed federal charges against him for assaulting a federal officer. And so within, I want to say, 5 days, the charges were dismissed because of questionable reporting in the reports and some other things. But he was detained for 6 days, and he's an American citizen. And so another example, a young man, or not a young man, the father of seven American citizens, ranging in age from 2 to 20. And was working as a roofer, and so he was in his roofing truck, and ICE officers came and asked him for his immigration status. He didn't have any. He didn't open his window, and so they busted out his window, and so then they shot him with a taser, and then by that time the person in the back seat was taking video, and so you can hear these ICE officers in Spanish saying, "Do you want another? Do you want another?" Asking, "Do you want us to shock you again with the taser?" And he's saying, no. And then they do. And then after that, they're able to get the door open. They cut off his seat belt, and then he's taken into custody. And so talking to kind of law enforcement experts, that there are provisions, there are handbooks for ICE officers, just the same way there are for police and sheriffs. And those tasers are intended to be used as less lethal forms of force when your life is in danger. They've never been intended to be able to, never been intended for use to force compliance ever. And so, these are all civil rights lawsuits waiting to happen. The problem is that these people are detained. Oftentimes, they can't pursue those things.
So, in what instance is it acceptable for a law enforcement officer, federal or state, to throw someone to the ground and kick their teeth out?
Well, I don't know that there ever is an, I mean, once somebody has been subdued and they're no longer a threat, as far as I understand it, I've never been through an academy, but that you're not no longer allowed to be able to use that kind of force. And so early on in the administration, they talked about using a shock and awe approach to enforcement. And so I think that meant increasing the number of officers, but I also think it meant paying less attention to what's in their handbook and trying to be able to create fear. And so Arnold, his question, as far as the people are leaving, yes. I mean, the family of the gentleman who got tased, right? And so his oldest son is 20 years old. He's going to stay, but the other six American citizen kids and the wife, they're going back to Mexico, right? And so there are other circumstances, other issues where some people, rather than take the chance, have decided to be able to leave. And so as a result, whenever I talk to other people who have businesses, it seems like, contractors that work in drywall or in roofing, that it seems like it's kind of the cycle where now there's less work because there are fewer homes being built. Because there are concerns from home builders that they're not going to have the labor that they need to be able to get those jobs done.
Well, and talking about the tactics involved in this, and this doesn't get at the notion of profiling, but that's something we can talk about too. But this raises or reminds me that you have some legislation proposed this session that tries to ensure that people know who the heck they're being stopped by, and to give them some idea of, what the reasoning is, right?
Yes. And so I did come up with a bill because I was trying to think, because I understand federalism and I understand that for better or for worse, ICE officers are regulated by the federal government. There's not a lot that the state of Oklahoma can do. But what I did is I came up with a bill that would create basically it would prohibit state and local law enforcement from using masks to hide their identity. And so that doesn't mean that they would be prevented from using face shields or other things when those are necessary. But if they wanted to use a mask to be able to hide their identity, then they would need to go and get a court order. The same way that they would go to get a court order for a search warrant or for an arrest warrant. If it's determined that somehow they might be in danger, I think perhaps there are circumstances when that might happen. That absolutely they could use a mask, but they would need to be able to get court authorization before they did it. And
So,
so again, I think part of it was to be able to ensure that we manage and we regulate state and local law enforcement. But the other idea behind the scenes was to be able to see if there's ever a move from the federal government to try and conscript our law enforcement, to be able to either force them or try to force them to be able to ride with ICE to be able to do some of these things. I can't regulate those ICE officers and what they do, but the my bill, as it was proposed, would still impact and require state and local law enforcement for every single arrest they would have to go and get for each arrest, basically, they'd have to go and get a court order before they could do it.
So was part of this also in response to the governor basically ordering the Highway Patrol and state agency officials to cooperate fully with the federal government in these immigration matters?
Well, and so yes, the governor did sign a 287G agreement for the Department of Public Safety, which includes the Highway Patrol. And so I understand that Highway Patrol was able to provide was able to receive, I'm not sure, I want to say less than a week's worth of training. And then the strategy in Oklahoma, I think, is unique because what they've done is they've stationed for the most part, the Highway Patrol. The times when they've arrested the most people is when they station people at our state's borders. And basically, and so they pull people over. And the focus seems to have been on foreign truck drivers, which was an issue that came up toward the end of last session, that there are certain people who are able to get provisional driver's licenses, mostly out of California. Even though they didn't have legal permanent residence. Oftentimes they're employed by trucking companies driving cross country. And so rather than focus on people on the south side of Oklahoma City, the Latino community, those roofers, landscapers, and construction workers, it seemed like they were more focused on people who were coming into the state of Oklahoma.
Well, and Marianne, you've seen some setups driving back and forth up and down I-35.
Yeah, I've heard. I actually work at the university at a university in North Texas, and so
Okay.
I remote sometime, and so I'm back and forth often. And there's been some interesting like videos and social media activity about like I-35 being all traffic being diverted off of I-35 going northbound at the border, and so that's
I
terrifying.
think that the governor was able to focus on another issue rather than sending the highway patrol to be able to conduct raids in say, for example, in Oklahoma City or East Tulsa or in Guymon. This was a different a unique way to use immigration enforcement. And so it was, like I said, it was an issue that came up toward the end of last year as far as safety concerns with some of these drivers. Whether or not they're able to read English, whether or not they're able to write English, and maybe what the amount of their training is before they put them in 18-wheelers driving. And so to me, selfishly, I mean I think the amount of risk that happens to the people in my district is much less if that's the overarching focus of Highway Patrol.
I just wonder though, it just seems like a slow drip towards like the federalization of the police, because right before all of this immigration enforcement really ramped up at the last half of this year of 2025, we of course saw the homeless encampments,
Yes, ma'am.
and the federalization of the OHP, to do that, and just kind of like this lingering federalization of our state police forces is a little un is a little un It makes me a little uneasy that we like to use federal force when it, when there's a policing function,
Yes.
but not when it, does anything else to help lift up the state. I just wonder if that has like particular impacts in your district.
Well,
Senator, I actually wrote my dissertation on 2007's immigration reform bill
oh, okay.
in Oklahoma. Yeah, and
I'll
so.
spill 1804 and Randy Terrell and all the
That
things.
is the one. Yeah, Randy Terrell, his name. Yeah, I yes.
I was up at the Capitol a lot during that time, even though I wasn't
Oh,
elected.
I
Okay.
imagine. And it's actually kind of the reason why I ended up back here. I mean, I grew up here, but
Yes,
I
sir.
ended up back here because I was reading that bill, and lo and behold, my old high school, very dear friend Scott Inman's name was on it. And so I reached out to him and I was like, why were you on this bill? And so that's the start of our we reconnected over
Yes.
that. So
Right.
anyways, all of this is to say is like I
You know
interviewed.
the person on, I apologize, but I can't hold back. You know the person who was on the other side of that issue was Shane Jett.
Yes. No, actually I do know that because that was one of the conversations that we had when I was talking to
Right.
him about this, because I also talked to Andrew Rice. I tried to talk to like multiple people, like all sorts of people involved with this piece of legislation. I talked to reporters that were about it. But yes, they talked about Shane Jett. They talked about his Brazilian wife, and they talked about how he like walked the vote basically, but he was
He did. I was there.
he was against the actual bill. He spoke against it. And this was, the days of, I believe, Ryan Kiesel, a whole kind of flotilla of Pottawatomie County legislators that were like really holding people's feet to the fire. And so, I know it's weird how all these things happen because, I don't
Right.
think in a million years now would ever attach his name to a legislation like this. And then you see Shane Jett coming back.
Right.
Right. It's insane. But just kind of, I part of my field work for that, my dissertation was talking to the Latino Community Development Agency. And
Yes, ma'am.
they put me in contact with some of their clients. And so I was able to interview them. And you
Right.
really see the constellation of ways that immigration, even just discussions like this, really impact the community. And, they were afraid to take their kids to school, they were afraid to leave their houses. And, I think it's accurate to say that, with in the Latino community, the family is a unit.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, like in mass,
Yeah,
right? Like they
right.
all are involved. And so just the way that the repercussions of that through the community, I mean, I can't imagine that, your district is really just kind of like, meh, everything's okay.
No, everybody is not okay this time. And so back in 2007, with House Bill 1804, actually, I think I was serving on the board of the Latino Community Development Agency at that time. And
Okay, that's
so,
crazy.
yeah, see, everything comes full circle.
It really
But
does. Yeah.
I think that I don't think that the level of enforcement in Oklahoma City was kind of earth-shattering at the time. We were concerned about the policies, but people who, best of my knowledge, no one was ever arrested in Oklahoma County for harboring and someone who was undocumented or for transporting someone who was undocumented. So the actual impact and charges actually filed on some of those things that were the most troubling didn't happen, at least in Oklahoma City. However, the impact in Tulsa was much more, much heavier, and I think much more traumatic in 2007 for sure. I think then we had there was a different sheriff, and so I think that the sheriff was cooperative in trying to pull people over at the time. I also believe that I heard over the years through other people who lived it in Tulsa that the police department was. And so that it's again kind of coming full circle. It's interesting because so far, the city of Oklahoma City, the police department's been largely silent on this, but they've worked hard to continue to maintain the relationships that they have within the Latino community to let them know that they're not concerned about immigration status. That at this point, they're most interested, if someone feels like they need to call the police, that they can feel safe in doing so. And the other thing, while they've been less explicit about it in Oklahoma City, in Tulsa, they've been highly explicit between the sheriff's office and the police department, reassuring people within the Latino community, if you're a victim of domestic violence and you need to call the police because you need help immediately, you can do so with confidence that it's not going to blow up in your face and you're the one who's going to be detained.
Wait,
And
I think this
so,
is worth unpacking just a little bit more, because when
yes,
you
ma'am.
think kind of the community, the way it ripples out through the community when people are afraid to call the police, like what that actually means. So again, like you're saying, domestic violence situations, but also crime in general.
Amen. Yes.
And just community policing efforts, right?
Right.
All of that crumbles with the idea that you're going to be reported and deported. By simply calling the police, which,
Right.
the years of trust that may have been built up.
And so, yeah, other examples are if there's a drug house, someone's selling drugs out of the house next door to you, right? If you believe that the police or the sheriff's office is going to ask you your immigration status and take you into custody, obviously you're less likely to call them and tell them about the problem next door. Or if you've been a victim of violent crime, or right now, I mean, it's also prevalent that you have people who are getting scammed, that people who are scared to death, who unfortunately that the current federal immigration law doesn't provide them an opportunity to apply for residence, but they're so desperate that they continue to look and look until they find someone who will make them a promise and charge them money. And so there are unscrupulous attorneys, most of them on social media, but there are also notaries, right? And so a notario in Latin America is something very much similar to an attorney. And so people here in the United States are aware of that. And so they'll spend $25, $50, get a notary seal, put a sign out in their front yard that says notario, and they will charge thousands of dollars, oftentimes to be able to file fraudulent applications, because people are desperate and just want to feel like they're getting something done. And so as a result, again, in being scared or nervous to be able to call law enforcement when you've been swindled as well.
So that sign goes out on the front yard, and your neighbors can't report it because of all the reasons we just talked about. So it's just the,
Right.
yeah. Wow.
Golly.
And
Well,
so, yes, go ahead.
no, go ahead.
No, I'm a.
Okay. Well, no, I was just this all brings me then around to Senator Grellner's bill, 1554, that basically would make it a felony for houses of worship and nonprofits to assist anyone who's undocumented, even if they're in the asylum process, formally in the process. It's just mind-boggling that what these fertile minds, I guess we'll call them, come up with to find it. And thankfully, it doesn't. It at least initially doesn't appear like that bill is getting much traction. But what does that say about us as a people? And what do you think the chances are that that sort of thing could move forward, particularly in an election year?
Well, I think some of it is based on current events. And so at this point, I know that we have received a lot of engagement on that particular bill. And it's been interesting because we've had kind of those normal advocates that are there and oppose these types of bills. But it seems like we're getting other allies, other people that this may be the spot that crosses the line. And so we're receiving calls from pastors and letters from retired pastors from probably what I would presume are fairly conservative evangelical churches that this is a bridge too far. This is the thing that I don't think that they can stomach is, basically, for me as a person of faith, the way that I understand my faith is that I'm taught to be able to offer help to those people when they're in need instead of criminalizing it. And so and I think, as much as things have been, I think, mischaracterized and kind of I think kind of certain positions have been kind of hijacked. That ultimately getting back to those core tenets of most religions, I think, which is that there's the duty to be able to help others when they're in need. And so, if someone's applying for asylum, it's because they've been they've been someone who's either suffered persecution or are likely to be tortured if they're returned back to their country. And so, how can you criminalize a place of worship or a nonprofit offering help and support to those types of people? Same thing oftentimes for people who are undocumented, the way that the United States works, and I think one of the things that has made it successful is that I mean, to some degrees it's hierarchical, but it's been one of the things is the steady flow of immigrants that are willing to come start at the bottom, but they know that the United States is different because their level of success is only limited by how hard they're able to work. And I understand that there, I mean, that may be a generalization and there may be more nuance to it, depending on your race, your gender, and some of those other things. But that's the American dream. And at this point, to kind of criminalize that, because I have clients who've been architects or attorneys or professionals in their country, but they're limited in what they can do and how far they can go, and have actually come to the United States and taken jobs as dishwashers, all with a dream to be able to provide a better life for their kids. And so, when you have, especially legislators who are new, right, who maybe this is, this isn't their first session, but it's their first term running bills like this. Like I said, I think a lot of it's a lot of red meat at the beginning of session, just to be able to fortify their conservative credentials with the people in their district.
But how does that fortify your credentials to actually, this is a religious freedom issue, and this is something that it seems to me a lot of people on the evangelical right feel very strongly about. I can tell you from personal experience, and I don't go to an evangelical church, but my minister for the first time a week ago today actually mentioned a bill by number. At the legislature, and it was Grellner's bill, and it was like, oh my goodness, because he said, we have a food pantry out in front, to help, and he said, we could get charged, arrested, and fined, and all that, for stocking that and not knowing who is collecting from the pantry.
Well,
So.
I mean, I think there's a certain, for me at least, a little cynicism in the whole deal, because I mean, since President Trump has taken office, I mean, in my community in the south side of Oklahoma City, we've been terrorized all this time, and so but trying to be able to figure out when the larger community kind of takes notice or engages. Sometimes certain things have to happen. And so when people were asking me about it and why more people from the larger community maybe weren't engaging, I kind of went back to the civil rights movement and the fact that those people of conscience, those people of faith, oftentimes it didn't hit them until they saw video or pictures of people with blood all over them, right? Because they'd been beaten. And then finally it hit some sort of a nerve or impacted their conscience where they couldn't abide it anymore. And so I think with the two homicides in Minneapolis, I think with some of the other things that people are starting to see, it's starting to in you know the potential to try and criminalize people, pastors, religious workers, volunteers, people that work at nonprofits. Finally, you know, after several months of going through this kind of in a lonely way, it's heartening to know that we have allies. And I have to say that one of the allies that we have had consistently, at least since last session, is the what is it, the American Association of Evangelicals. And so whenever we were having Hispanic Heritage Day last year, and we'd organized a closed door meeting with the governor to discuss issues and concerns having to do with some of these issues, they were some of the first ones to be able to call us. And I know that they've worked really, really hard with our federal delegation as well. And so it's kind of interesting bedfellows because I know that probably we don't agree on a lot of issues, but it's interesting on and how some at least on some of these issues that our interests and our strategies align.
Were you surprised at all that both the House Speaker and the Senate President seemed to be supportive of this notion that we should be investigating these student walkouts and whether teachers were involved in those sorts of things? That, you would like to think in a more perfect world that the leaders of the two chambers would have a little more sober, approach to these kinds of things.
Well, I think, I mean, kind of, you know, reminiscent of the civil rights movement, you know, civil disobedience puts the people in power. It makes them feel uncomfortable, right? And so when you have kids that cannot abide this and they walk out of class, or you have other individuals who won't move, right? Who refuse to move to block, you know, maybe they're blocking access to something for law enforcement or something else like that. And as a result, they're assaulted. And we're talking about American citizens or unfortunately up in Minnesota, even killed in these situations when you have people who are exercising the right to be civilly disobedient. You know, it's the whole strategy, the whole idea is to make those people in power feel uncomfortable, right? Until their conscience kicks in and they stand up as well. And so it's an uncomfortable situation, but I think that this is not to make it overblown, but I think this is a real situation where that's what's going to have to happen to be able to harness the what I believe or I hope is still the conscience of the American people that this is not the right thing.
And to think that this whole conversation started with the kids that are walking out of school, right? Like that's kind of,
Well,
I mean, it's very hopeful, right? I mean, that actually gives me a lot of hope because I feel like this is a moment, you know, this is something they'll remember for the rest of their lives and they'll take this consciousness with them, right? It may go different places, but like I said at the beginning, I think the kids are all right. I really do.
I went to church this morning. It wasn't the right Bible quote, but from the mouths of babes, right? I mean, sometimes I think as you get older, you can make deals with yourself and you can rationalize things that maybe aren't right. But when you hear it from a kid, it all of a sudden it makes sense, right? And there's a certain honesty and purity about it that you can't rationalize away.
I mean, and also just the idea that this is happening at a point in their lives where their worldview is really kind of gelling, you know, like their sense of the world, of right and wrong. And so many of these kids are going to be voting by the time the next presidential election comes up. They're going to be voting by the fall. You know, that actually gives me a lot of hope,
Right.
that, you know, maybe we have a chance to get through this really dark moment. You know, my oldest is in college right now. She's a freshman year of college, and
Right.
the things that she's doing, the way she sees the world, is very gratifying. Like, as a parent, okay, I did all right. You know, I did all right. I set her on the right path, and she hasn't strayed from it, right? Like, there's like they say. But no, I mean, I think this is really important that it's our kids that are doing this right now. You know, they're taking risks too for their peers that maybe can't. But it gives me great hope.
Me too. And so my only hope is my only additional hope, I suppose, is that it sustains, right? And so that and that this isn't the end. Hopefully this is the beginning, right? So hopefully so.
Right.
Well, I want you to know, for us, this is a Senator, this is a wonders never cease moment, in a sense, because we it's not often that we gather, you know, we gather in these conferences to talk about things that we just, it's hard oftentimes for us to imagine we're really having these conversations in 21st
And we
century
wish we
America.
weren't
Yeah,
for
and we
5 years
wish
now. We
we
wish we weren't. Yeah, 6 years. Yeah.
and we're usually at the end of the conversation, as it's wrapping up, we're begging for some nugget of hope to come out of it. And for this one to sort of end, you know, this way is very gratifying and heartwarming, actually. And follows up, I got an email from a friend of mine who's in his mid-90s, a couple of days ago, and he took a picture of the front page of the Norman Transcript, and it was the students walking, the story about students walking out of out of Norman. And he said, between that and your meeting, our newsmakers meeting at Full Circle, we had the largest crowd we've had in years, maybe ever. And the night before, and he said, mostly gray hairs, I might add. And he said, but between the gray hairs and the kids, he said, I'm feeling a whole lot better about where we are, than I did a few weeks ago. So
Well, I mean, no,
let's.
absolutely. And so, yeah, hopefully they can keep it going. But yeah, when you see, walkouts in El Reno, right? You see in rural areas that finally things have been pushed to the point where kids aren't going to stand for it. And I think, like I said, they provide a clarity that sometimes the rest of us we start to get distracted or rationalize things in a certain way. That there's a certain degree of truth and sincerity when it comes from kids.
I mean, even if it just kind of jostles some people's complacency, you know, just a little
Right?
bit, like to
Well.
pay attention. And I think it's interesting to me that these students have really been, especially this year, where they Oklahoma students don't have access to their phones during the day,
Right?
right? You know, I mean, just like really though, the power of social media, you know, and just, oh gosh, the targeting, the algorithms, all that sort of stuff, the content that they're getting. You know, I think there's the real potential for a lot of good to come out of this. So,
I certainly hope so, and I think it's gratifying, and hopefully it sustains. Hopefully we're able to. And the other thing I think is that for kids, they're also not afraid to have difficult conversations with their parents. And so when their parents may not feel the same way, but oftentimes the kids they're more willing to confront their parents than maybe a friend or a colleague would. And so maybe there will be good conversations going on in houses as well, amongst families.
Well, let's hope.
Hopefully
So,
so.
yeah, thank you so much for your time today. I know we've all got to head out, but it was great to talk to you. Great to talk to you about these issues. Hopefully they just continue to get better and not worse in the weeks to
Hope
come.
so.
The session is new, but I know, I'm just like, oh my gosh, deadline weeks are approaching already. So,
Well, I'm counting the days for that deadline week, because then out of those 35 anti-immigrant bills, then we can see if there are any that have legs.
Right. I mean, if they can be able to draw down in committee, right? Like, right. Please. All right. Thank you so much, sir. Have a great evening. And I hope we get to talk to you again.
I appreciate very much the opportunity. If you guys would have me again in the future, I'd be honored. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comforted. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances, at jareddeckmusic.com.